Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at It's Alive, originally from 1974, although most of its fans are more likely to remember it from its 1977 re-release, which had a much bigger promotional push and was the source of most of its commercial and critical success. Written and directed by Larry Cohen. Now, Cohen is a filmmaker I've wanted to talk about for a while on this podcast, because he's one of those maverick writer-directors that really have an outsized impact on the genre. He made very few films that achieved mainstream success, but almost everything he did lived on for decades in that strange radioactive world of late-night cable repeats and the horror section of the local video store. He had a knack for mixing social commentary and trashy exploitation in a way that made audiences ask questions rather than simply pondering the message they were given, and he's made a few genuinely timeless cult classics that I'm either going to cover or at the very least would like to. If you need titles, think Cue the Winged Serpent, The Stuff, God Told Me To, and Maniac Cop, although his fingerprints have been all over a whole bunch of other extremely strange and fun movies. He also has a weird tangential connection to another favorite writer of mine. It was Cohen's script Cast of Characters that was the subject of a lawsuit against 20th Century Fox, claiming that they cannibalized his pitch for the movie and handed it off to comic book writer Alan Moore to turn into the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and forcing the living legend to testify that his idea was in fact his own idea. I'd heard the story many times from Moore's perspective, but I didn't know it was Cohen who was the aggrieved party in the entire mess. But to get to the specifics of this film, it of course had its origins in one of the most famous medical tragedies of the 20th century, the inadequate testing and misleading marketing of the drug thalidomide. That drug is now used in certain cancer treatments and by patients dealing with the disease leprosy, but in the 1950s it was sold over-the-counter in many countries as a sleep aid and anti-nausea medication. It was specifically marketed to pregnant women as an antidote to morning sickness, which was brutally ironic considering that it had a teratogenic effect causing phocomelia, or for those of you who, like me, have to look all this stuff up on Wikipedia, it interfered with the formation and development of a growing fetus. The window of danger was short and highly specific, occurring between day 20 and day 36 post-fertilization, but those babies whose mothers had taken thalidomide within that window could be born with missing or incomplete arms and legs, brain damage, and in many cases damage to the heart or lungs too severe to allow the baby to survive. Some 20,000 infants were estimated to have been affected by the drug, most in the UK and Europe. The FDA blocked the drug from its American release, thankfully, and approximately 40% of them died at or shortly after birth. The survivors were often disabled and needed support and assistance for everyday activities, as well as medical care for issues with their hearts or urinary tracts. The drug was removed from most markets in 1961 and finally banned in 1968, but the horrific impact it had on the quality of life for its victims led to an international fascination with the scandal that was still very much present when Cohen wrote his screenplay. The novelization of It's Alive specifically ascribes the newborn's unusual physical characteristics to mutations caused by fertility drugs, but Cohen decided wisely, I think, to be a little cagier about it. Now, Cohen was notoriously reticent to ascribe meanings to his own work, preferring to simply release his movies and let people find their own messages in them, but I think you do have to point to two other cultural factors that went into the creation of the film. The first is the Roe v. Wade decision handed down by the Supreme Court in 1973 to strike down laws against abortion. I don't want to say this ignited a national debate about abortion, because the state's role in legislating abortion has always been a hotly debated topic throughout history and all over the world, but it definitely brought the issue very directly into the public eye and forced many people to consider the question in a way they'd been able to previously avoid. given that one of the most important reasons in the mind of many is the health of the mother and the viability of the fetus, it really comes as no surprise that Cohen would come up with a story that involved a child that was a legitimate danger to public safety. The other major factor was the political landscape of California in 1974. This movie is set in that state, and at the time it was released, Ronald Reagan was just finishing out his second and final term as governor. The future president ran on a platform very similar to the one he would use to gain the White House in 1980. Punish the poor people for being poor, punish liberal college students for being smart, punish black people for existing, and reward the rich with lucrative property tax breaks while implementing regressive sales taxes that disproportionately affected the working class. While he was definitely more liberal than he would be later on, he did have to triangulate his personal politics against the relatively progressive electorate he served, he nonetheless demonstrated a lot of the qualities that would come to make the Republican Party a byword for grift, bigotry, and pointless cruelty. The cops in this movie are fully down with murdering a baby on sight, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that Reagan is in charge. And if you disagree, you can get your own damn podcast. Cohen decided early on that the baby couldn't be shown much, the practicalities of having a stunt baby were prohibitive at best, but he did want it to make an impact when it was seen. So he went to a man who was rapidly developing a reputation as the best of the business, Rick Baker. Baker rejected Cohen's initial suggestion of making a baby costume that could fit on an animal, and instead used his then-girlfriend and later wife, Elaine Parkin, as the model for the infant in close-ups where the makeup would be most prominent, while creating a fake baby over an aluminum wire armature that could be posed and articulated for any full views. Sadly, we were not treated to a stop-motion murder baby. The rest of the movie was reliant on the actors to carry, being essentially a character study of two people caught between the scrutiny of a hostile public and their duty as parents. The baby's father, Frank Davis, is played by character actor John P. Ryan. Ryan specialized in villain roles, making this a rare sympathetic performance for him, although exactly how sympathetic remains to be seen. He played characters with a penchant for explosive violence in classic movies like Five Easy Pieces, Future World, The Cotton Club, Runaway Train, Class of 1999, Hoffa, Batman Mask of the Phantasm, and Bound, the movie that started the directing career of the Wachowski sisters. He passed away in 2007 at the age of 70. The mother, Lenore Davis, is played by Sharon Farrell. She was a character actor and day player who worked widely through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, making guest appearances on everything from Gunsmoke and Death Valley Days to The Fugitive and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. to The $6 Million Man and Kolchak the Night Stalker, all the way up to an episode of Freddy's Nightmares, the series we can only know by reputation. But to horror fans, she's probably most famous apart from this movie for her role as the catty stepmom to the Belmont sisters who gets vaporized by radiation in the cult classic Night of the Comet. She passed away in May of 2023. Most of the other characters only have brief appearances and get disproportionately high billing for them, but there are a few other members of the cast who crop up multiple times throughout the film. James Dixon, who plays Lieutenant Perkins in this film and the two sequels, was practically a member of the Larry Cohen Repertory Company, appearing in his blaxploitation films Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem, which was shot simultaneously with It's Alive, as well as God Told Me To, Full Moon High, Cue the Winged Serpent, A Return to Salem's Lot, Maniac Cop, Maniac Cop 2, and Wicked Stepmother. He also helped write and produce a few of those films. Apparently, it's just not a Cohen movie without Jim Dixon. The unethical Dr. Norton, who turns on the infant, treating it like a medical curiosity and not a person, is played by Seamus Locke. Locke was born in Ireland, as you can guess from his name, and had very few industry credits. He was in a few movies in the late 40s, an episode or two of television in the 50s, and this film. And I assume he spent his other time either teaching acting or doing stage work, because he pretty completely disappeared from Hollywood, but he died in California in 2003, so he must have been making some kind of living in the entertainment industry. Sadly, IMDb and Google aren't much help, although I was vindicated to discover the search engine has been getting objectively worse. so we may never know the details of his life and career. The same cannot be said of Daniel Holtzman, who plays Frank and Lenore's older son, Chris. Even though this is Holtzman's only acting credit, he's definitely still active and entertaining. He's a world-class professional juggler with multiple Guinness World Records pertaining to his talents, and touring appearances with comedy legends like Billy Crystal, Howie Mandel, and Robin Williams. He's performed for the president, he was brought in to entertain the sequestered O.J. Simpson jurors, and he even has his own podcast about juggling and comedy called Drop Everything, which is the best title ever. We can all go home now. This is the kind of trivia about a film that I freaking live for. Oh yes, and family friend Charlie is played by famous character actor William Wellman Jr., son of the director of the original A Star Is Born and the story of G.I. Joe, and a hard-working actor in his own right who appeared in High School Confidential, Billy Jack Goes to Washington, The Puppet Masters, the first VTV movie, and more guest appearances in genre television shows than you can shake a stick at. But I mean, come on. How much juggling did he do? Yeah, I thought so. And with the important warning that this is going to be an entirely juggling-free movie, let's dig in. We begin with the opening credits, which play out over a series of waving flashlights that won't get explained until the third act, and a bombastic, eerie score created by the legendary Bernard Herrmann, the man who wrote the classic yai, yai, yai score for Psycho. We then fade into a nice suburban California house where expectant mother Lenore wakes her husband Frank to let him know it's time to head for the hospital. They get ready with a calm, leisurely pace that really feels more appropriate for a Sunday drive than an impending birth. Both parents have time to dress up in their nicest clothes, wake their son, who's cuddling with the world's most patient Siamese cat, and get him dressed to deliver him to their friend Charlie until the baby's born, and take a long, loving look at the nursery that, for all I know, they just decorated. It really is the most low-key hospital trip in cinematic history, but of course it has to be for everything that comes afterwards to feel appropriately shocking. They drop Chris off at Charlie's, with Frank doing a Walter Brennan impression along the way that feels very dad-appropriate for the 70s. I don't think my dad had a bad impression of a famous actor he trotted out as a party piece, but he might well have been the only one. And they then head into the hospital, where Lenore is appropriately doted on by the staff, and Frank is, as is typical of dads in the era, left almost completely out of the process. He gets a visit to his expectant wife, led along by a Scottish nurse who gets to do a little comic business with Frank about his own Irish ancestry, but for the most part, he's sent out to play poker and smoke cigarettes with the other expectant fathers. There's a small element of the brief conversation between him and Lenore that hints at the notion that they took a long time to come to the conclusion that they wanted another child, and a discussion of pollution and insect adaptation to pesticides among the waiting dads that feels distinctly ominous, but otherwise this would have been seen as very normal for the time it was set, even though it's now a time capsule of an era where only one parent needed to be involved in the entire business of childbirth. But of course, if you've seen the trailers or the poster, you know it's all going to go horribly wrong. And sure enough, Lenore becomes concerned during the birth despite the doctor's insistence that everything's fine, it's just a very large baby and it's going to be a somewhat difficult labor. His reassurances are somewhat contradicted, though, when Frank sees a nurse stagger out of the OR with a violent gash across his throat and runs into his wife's surgical suite to find her screaming with terror and all the doctors and nurses brutally murdered. The umbilical cord was chewed through, and a broken skylight on the third floor indicates that the infant has escaped. Frank is dragged away, shouting invectives at the hospital staff he thinks has either stolen or killed his newborn child, and the police are quickly called in. When Lenore emerges from sedation, Dr. Norton and Lieutenant Perkins are there along with Frank, and they're both asking intrusive questions about exposure to mutagenic drugs or radiation. The doctor mentions that Lenore inquired about having an abortion, and when Frank explains that they asked about it strictly as a matter of routine and they have decided instead to have the baby, Perkins says, well, we all make mistakes, before apologizing for his tasteless comment. And let me tell you, if there's one theme that's going to continue throughout this movie, it's people's complete and total inability to handle this situation in a way that's remotely appropriate. Perkins and the doctor head outside to chat privately, while Frank reassures Lenore. She thinks the baby was just frightened by the shock and the unfamiliar situation, but Frank isn't really listening to her. He's coping in his own way, coming to the conclusion that he can't be the father because he isn't capable of having a child like that. This does have its roots in the thalidomide tragedy as well. The drug is transmitted through semen, so even if only the father was taking it, there was a chance of the developing fetus getting a dose. The received wisdom at the time was that foreign substances couldn't pass through the placental barrier, so there was no need to worry about a drug affecting the unborn, a wisdom that's changed only at great cost to a number of mothers and children. Frank goes out to talk to the two experts, and Dr. Norton's of the belief that the baby won't survive the night without food or shelter. Lieutenant Perkins, on the other hand, isn't so sure, and he's going to have his men searching for it until they have definitive proof that it's dead. Which is just a wild statement to hear at this point in the movie, even if the infant is dangerous. As The Simpsons pointed out, you'd expect to hear police issue a shoot-on-sight order for a baby in Texas, not California. It's blatantly obvious that the newborn child could have no reasonable moral framework for its actions, and killing it instead of capturing it seems unconscionable and inhumane, but that's going to be the stance of pretty much everyone we encounter over the course of the movie, and even Frank doesn't question it. He's decided it's more important to show everyone that he's a normal, everyday American and not associated with some kind of freakish weirdo, and he doesn't even so much as suggest they're doing anything wrong by killing his infant child when they inform him of their plans. It's hard not to see this as an analogy for LGBTQ issues, even though I don't think Cohen was remotely thinking in those terms when he wrote it. As my roommate pointed out, the message of the film is that your children deserve love and respect, even though it's very important to let them know that everyone in the world is going to want to murder them the moment they're born, and that's very relatable to queer people. As he leaves the hospital, with Lenore staying overnight for observation, Frank hears on the radio that news of the incident has leaked to the media and that both he and his wife have been directly named. Again, this feels very much like a time capsule moment. These days, I feel pretty confident that patient privacy laws would have some say in what got out to reporters, at least this close to the initial incident. But HIPAA didn't exist in 1974, and Frank and Lenore are now squarely in the public eye as the parents of a vicious mutant murder baby, with all the potential for a mass panic that entails. The baby, meanwhile, has gotten away from the hospital and out into the suburbs, where it attacks a woman who comes on it unexpectedly. Constantly afraid and with hair-trigger threat responses, it's anything but safe to approach. When Frank gets to the office the next day, the atmosphere is immediately tense despite his attempts to act like everything is business as usual, and he's soon called in for a meeting with his boss Bob, played by Guy Stockwell, brother of Quantum Leap actor Dean Stockwell. Bob acts sympathetic, telling him that, quote, these things happen, which seems like a pretty bizarre thing to say to someone whose infant child has murdered 6 people, but he's actually generalizing about children born with disabilities. He mentions that another employee at the company has a son with Down syndrome, that's not the term he uses for it, but it was the 70s and some of the language we consider very ableist today would have been clinical back then, and in general he tries to sound like he's on Frank's side. But he also awkwardly and uncomfortably lets Frank know that it looks bad for a public relations firm to have an employee involved in a major scandal, even one caused by events outside his control, and tells him to take his accrued vacation immediately. The second Frank leaves the building, pursued by a crowd of reporters, Bob tells the secretary to have Frank's desk cleaned out and his belongings sent to the house. It's a chilling and cruel reminder of the way that loyalty is never rewarded when money is at stake. Companies only care about what you can do for them. You don't have an intrinsic value as far as capitalism is concerned. That night, Frank picks up Lenore from the hospital and brings her home with nurses to help her convalesce, and pretends it was his decision to take some time off work to take care of the family. The next day, he calls Chris to tell him he won't be coming home for a little while because the baby's sick, and asks Charlie to make sure Chris stays away from both school and the TV news for a few days. Charlie decides to take Chris on a fishing trip for a while. The police find another body, and Lieutenant Perkins complains to his boss that maybe he's not cut out to hunt down a baby, what with his wife 8 months pregnant and a previous miscarriage weighing heavily on the couple's mind. The captain, who's played by legendary character actor Michael Ansara, aka Mr. Freeze from Batman the Animated Series and Kang from the original Star Trek, tells him, and I quote, "Look, you're lucky you don't have grown kids nowadays. People without children don't realize how lucky they are." I really feel like a whole theme of this movie is the way that deep personal tragedies honestly evoke discomfort instead of sympathy in far too many people, leading to toxic positivity as a coping mechanism instead of genuine support. Nobody knows what to say to a casual acquaintance who's really going through it, so they lean on bland platitudes to paper over the whole mess. At the Davis home, the new nurse asks a series of incredibly intrusive and personal questions that made me wonder on the first viewing just what the hell was going through her head, until both Lenore and I discovered at the same time that she's recording the whole thing in an effort to sell the story to the tabloids. Frank confiscates and breaks the tape, and tells her to get the hell out, and frankly, after that kind of scummy behavior, I think she's lucky not to get a black eye or two for her troubles. I can't even pretend this isn't something that would legitimately happen, both then and now, and I'm really impressed by the social commentary at every level of this story. Nobody cares about the Davis family, nobody's advocating for them, and that's just heartbreaking. This really is a horror movie that's more sad than scary. The baby kills a milkman, climbing into his truck to get some milk and attacking him when he startles it, and I know I was supposed to be horrified, but honestly I was more shocked to discover they were still regularly doing home delivery for milk as late as 1974. I somehow always associated that with the end of the 19th century, before the home refrigerator was invented, but according to websites like The Daily Meal and Drink Milk in Glass Bottles, milkmen clung on to a precarious existence in a shrinking market until as late as the 1990s. And they're making something of a comeback now, as people get accustomed to the convenience of home delivery for their groceries again. So, yep, this man might have been in a dying industry, but it's him who dies and not his job. And of course we get a lovely shot of the blood mingling with the spilled milk. The police show up, and for some reason there's a family in the neighborhood that's left their own personal baby in the backyard on a blanket, unsupervised, which seems almost surreally incompetent given that there's a murder baby on the loose with 8 kills to its credit. And we're treated to a very carefully staged scene of a half dozen policemen training their guns on an adorable infant. It's definitely another piece of social commentary on the nature of cops to look for the first suspect at hand rather than the one who actually did it, and I think we can consider Larry Cohen as part of the ACAB brigade as well. I mean, he did write Maniac Cop. He's clearly got a certain conflicted attitude toward law enforcement. A local professor of biology, played by Andrew Duggan, approaches Frank alongside Dr. Norton to ask him to sign over the baby's body to their science department after it's killed. Frank is clearly seething with barely repressed anger over this latest indignity, but he also doesn't want anyone to think he bears any kind of affection for the infant, so he signs the paperwork just to get them out of his hair. A lot of this movie's tension comes from just waiting for Frank to stop being a dick, I'll warn you that right now. He muses that the infant will become his legacy no matter how much he protests, with the Davis baby becoming as famous as the Frankenstein monster, which is a nice nod to the source of the film's title. Lenore, who's clearly stressed and anxious to the point of psychological fragility, comes downstairs despite her doctor's protests and sends her husband down to the basement for some wine. It's mainly an excuse for a cheap jump scare. Frank is startled by a piñata that falls on him, but it also serves to hint that maybe the infant everyone's looking for is closer than anyone thinks. After all, if it's got the strength and agility to kill full-grown adults, is it really that much more far-fetched to imagine that it's got the ability to track its parents by scent? After leaving the Davis residence, their doctor meets with an executive from a pharmaceutical company played by Robert Emhart with a rotund form and a white goatee and a nasal, reedy voice that unfortunately gives off the impression of a munchkin from The Wizard of Oz who somehow got blown up to normal size. I don't mean to criticize the man's appearance, but it is very distracting because he really looks exactly like a munchkin, only, you know, closer to 6 foot tall. The executive suggests that it might be a good idea if the causes of the baby's mutation were never discovered, since they'd be vulnerable to lawsuits if it turned out to be related to products they manufactured, a reference to the companies who produced thalidomide, who wound up paying millions in settlements to the families of children affected by the drug. He blatantly bribes Dr. Norton to arrange for the total destruction of the infant in exchange for a generous position within the company, spurred on by the notion that Lenore's doctor might be held liable as well for prescribing whatever caused the mutation. As dusk falls, the police corner the baby at the local elementary school, something Frank finds out about when they call his house looking for Dr. Norton. He walks over to the school, which is also where Chris goes when he's not being kept out, and is brought to Lieutenant Perkins to discuss the situation. Perkins is immediately interested in the apparent coincidence of the infant's interest in the same school his brother attends, but of course they've got the baby trapped now, so whatever reasons it had for coming here don't matter. Only, of course, the baby kills a cop and breaks through the police cordon, escaping back into the night. It really is kind of hilarious how badly the trained law enforcement officers keep getting their asses kicked by a 12-pound infant, even if it does have superpowers. The next day, the milkman delivers 5 bottles to Frank's house, which seems like a lot for 3 people, but I suppose we don't know how often they get their deliveries, and it's clear that the stress of the situation is taking its toll on the couple. Lenore has a frantic, nervous energy to all her conversations, almost like she's hiding something, even though that would be impossible. Ha ha ha, why would you even suggest such a thing? And Frank is just drained and exhausted by it all. He spends most of the day sleeping and wakes up in the evening to find Lenore strangely absent from both the upstairs and the downstairs portions of the house. Just as he's thinking about looking for her in the basement, she pops up out of nowhere, suggesting they sit down together and watch some television. She's clearly not doing great, and Frank gets the first hint of a reason why when he goes to get something to eat and finds that all of the bottles of milk they just got that morning are already empty. He at first assumes that Lenore's decided to bring home Chris without telling him because she's been talking about wanting to get together as a family again, but even though Chris's room is now a mess and the cat is obviously pissed about something, there's no sign of their older son. He calls Charlie, hoping to catch Lenore in a deception, but Chris is there, and Lenore gets even more tense and frantic the moment she sees him trying to use the phone. She tries to distract him with an offer of sex, but most of the food is now gone from the fridge, and Frank finally begins to piece together exactly what she's been feeding, just as Chris decides to give Charlie the slip and head for home. I could, if I was so inclined, point out that babies that young can't digest cow milk or solid food yet. Then again, babies that young can't murder 9 people, so I think it's safe to say we're exercising some special pleading here. Frank checks the nursery, but even though we see the blankets in the bassinet shifting ominously as he approaches, there's nothing there when he pulls the covers away. The mattress is still warm, though, and something slips out the door behind him, so he gets his gun and goes down to the basement to search for the mutant child he knows must be down there as Chris races home and Charlie races after him. Lenore tries to beg him to stop, telling him that the infant boy won't hurt his own family, but of course, Frank's fully disowned his own child and wants to show everyone that he's a good, normal member of society by killing the freakish outsider. Again, you can read a lot of queer analogies into this. Chris comes home through the cellar door, which is definitely a choice that makes sense for him and not an excuse to force a confrontation with his little brother who has, sadly, killed the family cat. Or a cat, at least. The actual family cat let Chris hold him like a teddy bear while he slept, and I can't believe that cat would evoke any kind of threat response in even a mutant murder baby. So this is obviously just a feral stray with rabies who resembled the family cat, and our heroic murder baby did what he had to do. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Naturally, everything goes disastrously wrong. Frank takes a few shots at his infant son, winging him and sending him fleeing into the night. Charlie, who happens to be blocking the baby's path, gets his throat slashed for his troubles, becoming kill number 10, even though Chris instinctively recognizes that his brother won't hurt him and tries to calm him down. Lenore screams at Frank for attempting to murder their son, and he responds by slapping her and making it clear that he doesn't think he's the father. And once Frank calls the police and they follow the trail of blood, they realize the infant is hiding in the sewers and they decide to go in after him. Frank offers to help, and Dr. Norton suggests bringing him along because the baby clearly seems to have some connection to his birth family and might seek Frank out if he's present. So in a blatant and obvious violation of police procedure, Lieutenant Perkins agrees to let Frank accompany them and gives him a gun. One montage of searching the neighborhood later, and I love that we see an ice cream truck with the double-meaninged message, "Stop, children," emblazoned on the back, and they have a good idea of what sewer grate it's entered and where it might be headed next. The whole next day is taken up with a search of the sewers, with some shots of the Los Angeles River culvert used to mark the beginning of their hunt. This is, of course, a classic LA film location, appearing in everything from Blue Thunder to Chinatown to The Core to Grease to Terminator 2 to Them to Transformers to The Dark Knight Rises, and that doesn't even cover a tenth of the movies that use it. And it just gives me a little thrill as a cinema fan to see it here. The cops bring in flashlights to illuminate the darkened tunnels, which is what we saw in the opening credits, albeit in a stylized form. The tunnels are so wide they can even bring police cars into the area, and there's a wonderfully surreal shot of the baby briefly illuminated by the flashing red lights as he hides himself from the pursuing cops. I will say that it's a little disappointing that you never get a full good view of the infant, but I understand. It's 1974 and the technology for animatronics just isn't there yet, and with CGI not even in its infancy, the only way to render it would be to use an adult with forced perspective or stop motion. And babies have very distinctive proportions that even Rick Baker couldn't fake with a costume and makeup. So it'd be stop motion, which always looks like stop motion and wouldn't fool anyone. Cohen was doing the best he could with the technology at his disposal. In the end, Frank is the one to find his son, and when he comes face to face with the infant, he finally has the face turn we've been waiting for since pretty much 10 minutes into the movie, and realizes this is his child after all, and that all the poor thing wants is to be held and comforted. He wraps him up in his coat, which conveniently makes it impossible for us to see him, and carries him out of the cold, wet sewers. By now, night has fallen again, and he's surrounded by a whole squad of police that aren't interested in de-escalating the situation, and a doctor who's openly urging them to kill Frank if they have to in order to destroy his mutant baby. And Lenore, who was for some reason ferried over by the cops so that they can murder her child while she watches, I guess? Frank tries to plead with them, saying, "It can't hurt anybody," and even though he later qualifies this by explaining that it's injured and weak, his initial assertion is pretty risible considering the infant's body count. Perkins warns him that if he doesn't set the baby down and move away, they'll open fire on both of them, which is, as we've discovered over the last several years, exactly how the cops handle confrontations with anyone who isn't a straight white guy, and then, well... let's just say there was a little dispute about the ending. See, what Wikipedia says is that the baby lunges out of Frank's grip and savages Dr. Norton, killing him shortly before the cops open fire and gun him down. And maybe that was the intent of the film? But unfortunately, as previously mentioned, they're under a lot of technical limitations in terms of what they can really achieve. So as the scene is shot and staged, it genuinely looks like Frank gets fed up with his family doctor's demands to have his child shot and simply hurls the baby directly at him as a final act of revenge. And if you gave me 100 guesses as to how this movie would end, surprise projectile murder baby would still not have made the list. I was legitimately flabbergasted the first time I saw this. With the infant dead, the police bring the Davises home to their surviving son to mourn and reflect. But as Perkins is driving them away, he gets a call on the radio. Another mutant has been born in Seattle. Whatever caused this, it's not over, and perhaps it may never be. Which is honestly the best way to end this, an acknowledgement of the hubris inherent in simply trying to suppress and destroy our problems with violence instead of treating them with respect and understanding. This movie is a wild ride, with plenty of bizarre and unbelievable situations, but the message it sends is ultimately one I wholeheartedly agree with. And will I hang on to this movie? Yeah, it's one I was very pleased to find at the store. This is actually a three-movie set, with all three films in Cohen's It's Alive trilogy, and while I'm already a fan of Cohen's, I'd never actually sat down and watched these movies until it was time to do them for the pod. And this first one, at least, definitely doesn't disappoint. So it's staying on my shelf, and I'm really looking forward to following along with the sequels and finding out where the ride goes from here. And if you want to talk about surprise projectile murder babies, imposter cats, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, I have a special treat for you, I have to admit. There are horror movies I love, there are horror movies I respect, and then there are those very special movies that feel like they're just on a whole other level of art that make you shiver with the joy of touching the sublime. And I gotta say, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is one of those movies, and I can't wait to share it with you. See you then.